The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Tropical hot dog night.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Dave's Gone By, 90 minutes of talk radio, comedy, music, interviews, and more, coming to you live not from Merrick, Long Island, or even Freeport, Long Island, but from my cozy little home a few miles away. I'll explain. It's a weird confluence of circumstances. If you're in your cars or looking out any particular window, you'll see that it's already begun snowing, and they're looking for basically the monster storm of this season, possibly the last few years, which is one thing. Plus, I am under the weather. So with all that going on, I figured I would take the day, not head into the studio, do what I could over the phone, which totally changed my game plan for the show, unfortunately. I'm not going to be able to play the music that I wanted to. I also apologize for the quality of my voice, which is better now than it was this morning, thank goodness, or else this would have been nails on a blackboard time. But I will, I will do my best. Forgive me for coughing and sneezing or whatever else happens in the next half hour or so. And then in the 8 to 9 hour, a few weeks ago I prepared an emergency tape. It was part of the contractual agreement with the radio station. They want you to have a tape ready in case of emergency, in case you can't come in. Well, it took a few weeks, but this day was it. So what will happen is from the 8 to 9 hour, we'll be hearing a special edition of Dave's Gone By that I did devoted to the music of Bob Dylan. So if you like that, stick through this first half hour of talking and you have that to look forward to. Anyway, this winter is getting to me. To quote Natalie Merchant, I get a shiver in my bones just thinking about the weather. And, you know, I'm pretty okay with the winter season. I figure when it's 90 degrees in the shade in the middle of summer, I'll miss the cold and snow. But the past few years, you know, winter has meant a couple of very cold days, usually followed by a week where it's in the 50s, okay? Or a 6-inch snowstorm stays on the ground a night or two, but then melts into something manageable. But this year, it's enough. The groundhog didn't just see his shadow. He ran screaming back to his cave and shot himself. And I have to say that I have been lucky until now. Since I went on the air in early October, I have not had a cold, not one sniffle or flu symptom. I spent the whole winter healthy as a proverbial horse. And then, this week, wham, Wednesday afternoon, I'm coming back from the radio station, heading into the city. I'm standing on the platform of Freeport train station, which has to be the coldest, dankest, most inhospitable place in the universe. I mean, explorers in Greenland send me emails. They're like, you went to Freeport? And man, the wind whipped just through me. And by the time I even had the brains to duck into a heated shelter, I knew I was a goner. First came the throat tickle, then a few sneezes, and by Thursday night, I had a full-blown head cold, which moved to my throat yesterday morning and is, thank God, slowly leaving my system. But again, if I sound a little different tonight or a little out of it, or more out of it than usual, my apologies, it's just the weather. And if my gravelly voice bugs you, it's because I've got a bug. And if I'm surprisingly phlegmatic, blame it on the phlegm. Anyway, I'm Dave, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, journalist, theater critic, and political animal. And my show aims to be an eclectic mix of smart talk, silly talk, serious talk, smelly talk too, musical excursions every Sunday night at 7:30. Happy President's Day tomorrow, February 17th. It's a mish of Lincoln's birthday this past Wednesday and Washington's birthday on Saturday, the 22nd. And I did a whole spiel a couple of weeks ago on why I feel we're disrespecting holidays in this country by always putting them on Mondays, no matter what the real holiday day is. The holiday becomes more about getting a day off, a 3-day weekend, than a tribute to whatever birthday or memorial it's for. I think it was wrong for Martin Luther King Day, certainly, and was wrong for Lincoln and Washington when they were separate, but now that they're together, I don't know how I feel. If you just lump everything into President's Day, you are belittling their individual achievements. But you're also free to honor the president of your choice, aren't you? I'm sure a lot of people in the South still have no desire to give Lincoln his due, and Washington just feels like a myth at this point. We have paintings of him, and we see his face on money, but any sense of George Washington's personhood is relegated to history books nobody reads anymore. And maybe some folks don't want to venerate either of these guys. Charter members of the Chester A. Arthur fan club, you know, they're like, hey, you know, it's our holiday too. And women's groups. Well, that James Polk, he didn't have the PR Lincoln had, but he had a great ass. I wouldn't mind being his intern. Yum. So, on today's Dave's Gone By, we're going to honor and dishonor presidents great and small, as is our wont. And in our limited live time, we'll give a look at the Gettysburg Address and see if it moved recently. And we'll do the weekly news gone by. So just a quick disclaimer, I rate my program DGB-13. That means I reserve the right to say 13 offensive or tasteless things during the course of the show, which you may not feel are appropriate for children. Nothing obscene or FCC 21, just a caution that some content might make the White House red room turn blue. A little cough, and we'll begin tonight's abbreviated show with a segment called Dave Goes Off. No, not off my rocker. My rocker is well-oiled and cushiony, and I'm staying on it until I get better. No, Dave Goes Off is a segment where I get to rant about things, or just discuss stuff that's on my mind about issues of the day, or more mundane matters. I've talked about everything from bowling to dog neutering to Pete Rose's gambling, but today we're going to stay political, in keeping with President's Day and with Lincoln's birthday, which was on February 12th. Lincoln remains, I guess, the second most revered, beloved president after Washington. Whatever his motivations for engaging the South in civil war, the results did lead to freedom for a chunk of the population. And his domestic policies outside the war included the Homestead Act, which encouraged people to settle out west. He helped lay the figurative tracks, for the Transcontinental Railroad. And he established a national currency and a linking of banks. He also had the good luck, bad luck, to be assassinated in office, cutting him down in his prime, but also ending his legacy before he had the chance to screw up or become a senile old coot. And it is one of the legends of rhetoric that two people gave speeches on November 19th, 1863, at the dedication of a cemetery for Union soldiers in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Professional speaker Edward Everett gave a two-hour oration, and nobody remembers a word of it. Abraham Lincoln spoke for 2 minutes, and school kids are still forced to memorize it. Now, Everett was no slouch. He was a former Secretary of State and president of Harvard College. But on this day, he started with this long lesson on how the ancient Greeks memorialized their casualties of war. Then he starts a rousing sermon about how great it was that the North won the Civil War instead of the South. But then he goes into detail of the whole military campaign leading to the Battle of Gettysburg. And then the battle itself, which lasts as long as the Ken Burns Civil War documentary, only without the photographs and pretty music. And he finally winds it up with an encomium for the glorious deeds of the dead. I swear, by the time Everett finished his speech, we were already in Vietnam. But seriously, Everett had the gift of gab. And I'll just read a few lines from early in his oration. Quote, "Who that hears me has forgotten the thrill of joy that ran through the country on the 4th of July, auspicious day for the glorious tidings, and rendered still more so by the simultaneous fall of Vicksburg, when the telegraph flashed through the land the assurance from the President of the United States that the Army of the Potomac, under General Meade, had again smitten the invader. Sure I am that with the ascriptions of praise that rose to heaven from 20 millions of free men, with the acknowledgments that breathed from the patriotic lips throughout the length and breadth of America, to the surviving officers and men who had rendered the country this inestimable service, there beat in every loyal bosom a throb of tender and sorrowful gratitude to for the martyrs who had fallen on the sternly contested fields. Legonation's fervent thanks make some amends for the toils and sufferings of those who survive. Would that the heartfelt tribute could penetrate these honored graves, unquote. Not bad, especially since people had longer attention spans back then and didn't need periods in their paragraphs. But even then, Lincoln swooped in, and his whole speech was almost as long as Everett's intro. So, is Lincoln's Gettysburg Address really that good? Well, let's check it out. 87 years ago. Now think about that. This is just interesting to me. 87 years, which means there were people alive during the time of this speech who were born during or before the American Revolution. Anybody living to like 95 or 100 might have had very specific memories of colonial America. And here it was, 1863, the cusp of the Industrial Revolution and the turning point of the Civil War. We think our times are moving very fast, and they are. But it must have been pretty amazing to be there for the very beginning of the U.S., then see it almost broken in half, and then come through it. Anyway, 87 years ago, our fathers, not our mothers, apparently, they were too busy cleaning kitchens and birthing babies, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Again, the word men instead of people or humans, so you can see why it took 100 years for women to get the right to vote. No coincidence that they called it women's suffrage. Though it sure was nice for the North and South to compromise and let blacks have 3/5 of a vote. Actually, that might not be a bad idea for Florida in 2004. But anyway, Lincoln continues. Now we are engaged in a great civil war. I wonder if that was the first time it was called that, the Civil War. Robert E. Lee certainly used the term, but I don't know if that was before or after. A great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation, so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in the larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. That's nice writing, the cadence of that sentence. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. Notice he used add or detract rather than the obvious add or subtract. That's an 8th grade writing lesson right there. Choice. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here. Well, that was certainly true for Everett. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. That's kind of an Everett-y sentence, very writerly. Probably looked better in the newspapers the next day than it sounded when he said it. But look how Lincoln got away from having to recount the whole history of the war just by saying, hey, why should I go over this? Nobody's going to remember what I say anyway. I wonder if Lincoln actually had like a 45-minute speech. And when he found out Everett was running on for 2 hours, he just started cutting frantically. You can just see Lincoln on the train car on the way to Gettysburg, X-ing out paragraph after paragraph. Let's see, all that strategy stuff about General Meade, out. General McClellan's horse story, too sentimental. Yes, I'll keep the consecrated stuff, and that line about the living and the dead, but the warm-up joke about the lesbian and the parrot, that's gotta go. And that line about all men being created equal. I don't know, I should keep it, but it's gonna get me killed in the South. Well, by the time Lincoln was through cutting, he had it down to 2 minutes. There were a couple of different drafts of the address, but they were essentially the same, very short, although I think in one he had a line praising Strom Thurmond. But all credit to him. Honest Abe cuts to the chase. It is rather for us to be here, he said, dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That's what we haven't had in a conflict here since World War II, a sense of national devotion to the cause behind the war, of the soldiers giving their lives not just because a few military higher-ups convinced the president it's a good idea, but because the world truly hung in the balance. People wanted to feel that with Korea, but that war turned out to be about defending a borderline, and then Vietnam. If we had gone in and kicked ass, yeah, it would have felt good, but we didn't. And that's when everybody started to wonder, where's the great task? Why are we sending 18-year-olds to give their last full measures of devotion in muddy rice fields for an ideology, capitalism over communism? And Vietnam became such a mess, people blamed the soldiers for doing what they were told to do. In recent wars, we've lost only a handful of men, half of them to friendly fire and accidents. Talk about losing people in vain. So now we've had the Twin Towers, and someone has to pay. We spent a year blasting the hills of Afghanistan looking for a ragtag rebel army, and that feels pretty good when the casualties are minimal. So we're going after bigger fish, the dictator of Iraq. And if he truly is directly connected to Al-Qaeda and helped facilitate the annihilation of the World Trade Center, then there is a great task ahead of us, to turn Baghdad into a giant sand trap between Saudi Arabia and Turkey. But if this is just about getting an anti-American leader out of the region, well, that would have played in 1950s. But we've lived with Castro, we've lived with Khrushchev, we can live with this guy. We here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, and that this nation under God. A couple of the drafts of the Gettysburg Address left out the under God part, but this version used it, which no doubt caused problems for 19th century high school principals, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Imagine the country still being young enough where a person could really feel that the government was made up of his peers, that the people were truly running things. And that was the end of Lincoln's speech. Bang! A knockout in the first round. Although the history books don't mention that Lincoln didn't just finish the speech and walk off the platform, he grabbed his top hat and he did an amazing rendition of When You're Smiling, including a ukulele solo so good, even the Booth family was impressed. As for the overall quality of the speech, well, it's so familiar, it's hard to gauge just how wonderful it must have been at the time. The sad part is that no current politician could say the last line, the one about a new birth of freedom, and government being for the people. No current politician can say that and sound like they mean it, let alone mean it. That's why I still think the best Gettysburg Address is 84 York Road, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, 17325. No reason that particular one, I just like the sound of it. And you are listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB AM 1240 Freeport, the station that serves your community. And I'm going to serve myself a little sip of tea, as you can hear if you're just tuning in. My throat's a little gone. I've had a cold for the past few days. And sorry about if it doesn't sound normal connection-wise either. I'm actually on the phone from my home, but doing some of the material I would have done in this week's show. And I'll repeat that in the rest of the show, from the 8 to 9 hour, I'll be playing a tape of a show that hasn't been played yet, of me talking about Bob Dylan music and playing Bob Dylan music as kind of an emergency show just for contingencies like these. But first, I want to get in a few of our news gone by, jokes and stories and anecdotes, basically the news of the past week as they spring from my oval orifice. Well, on the international front, oh, here comes a cough, NATO is in a tizzy over how best to respond to the seemingly unavoidable war between the U.S. and Iraq. A measure before the Council to protect Turkey during the conflict was rejected by France, Germany, and Belgium. The three countries are still opposed to the war, and they feel that passing a resolution to defend Turkey would serve as tacit approval for the American invasion. Turkey wants the resolution because it's letting the United States use military bases on its land to launch the attack. And they fear that neighboring Iraq will retaliate against them. They argue that all members of NATO are obligated to protect each other when one is besieged. That's kind of the point of NATO. England, Spain, and Eastern Europe have voted for the protection resolution. Italy voted against it, then for it, then against it, then for it. France abstained and then surrendered. In related news, massive peace rallies around the world are making it extra tough for the U.S. to form an international coalition that would back a war with Iraq. With Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix telling the United Nations that Baghdad is cooperating a little more, not 100%, mind you, just a little more, most of the countries represented at the UN, England and Spain excepted, pushed strongly for more inspection time and a delay of military action. An exasperated Colin Powell told the Council not to be fooled by Saddam Hussein's dirty tricks, and that his weapons of mass destruction could be hidden anywhere. At least one delegate agreed with that assessment, noting that the last four weapons of mass destruction used against America were hidden in airport terminals in Boston, Newark, and Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, North Korea is all but jumping up and down, yelling, "Daddy, Daddy, look at me, I have nuclear weapons." But the United States is like, "Go play with your toys. Daddy's busy right now." Through it all, Americans have been panicked into buying gas masks, poison antidotes, and portable oxygen, which is a waste of money because that equipment is already given out free with every meal at Taco Bell. In entertainment news, a weird synergy happened between film and television last week. The top-grossing movie in America, earning $24 million, was Matthew McConaughey and Kate Hudson in How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. On TV, the most-watched program was NASA in How to Lose 7 Folks in 10 Seconds. In more somber news, the remains of the 7 shuttle astronauts have apparently been identified and are being released to the crew members' families. Pardon me, but didn't the spacecraft disintegrate? Didn't it hit like a zillion degrees and burn up in the atmosphere? What remains could there be? You get the feeling NASA just took some iron filings and scattered them into 7 urns? You know, maybe a little matzo meal for the Israeli guy, some lentil powder for the Indian chick? What I really want to know is, how did the American government manage to collect and identify body parts from a vessel that disintegrated in the air, but they can't find one sickly Arab who keeps sending audio cassettes to Iraqi television? And why bother with a ground war in Iraq? Let's just build another space shuttle and strap a missile on it. We point them both at Baghdad. If one misses its target, the other will blow up. Meanwhile, Osama bin Laden is calling for other Arab countries to defend Iraq, even though he doesn't even want Saddam Hussein in power. He calls Hussein's Ba'ath government an infidel regime, untrue to the tenets of Islam, which makes it more difficult for the U.S. to prove Hussein and bin Laden are in cahoots, rather than just united in spirit against a common enemy, us. I think we should encourage Osama and Saddam to get together. Let them have a powwow at Hussein's palace and plan strategy. And then, when they're not looking, we divert a couple of M-16s and bam, the twin turbines. Then we send the ashes to Kim Il-jung in North Korea and say, "This is you next Wednesday. Feel like disarming?" We stop off in Cuba, give Castro an exploding cigar, and then we're done. Well, maybe save a grenade or two for Hempstead, but only if it really gets out of control. But once we start this war, we've got to go all the way. Imagine all the environments we can pollute, all the teenagers we can corrupt, all the economies we can ruin with just a couple of takeovers. Imagine the price of oil going down 5 whole cents. Imagine a falafel McCheese on every corner of Kabul. Imagine Al Jazeera Network having to show Joan Rivers infomercials to get ratings. Imagine things getting better in the next 12 months. No, sorry, I can't imagine that. In business news, Cablevision is cutting its losses and killing The Wiz. According to Newsday, the last remaining 17 Wiz electronics stores on Long Island will close at the end of June. Cablevision bought the bankrupt retailer 5 years ago and invested $500 million trying to turn the chain around. But times have been tough in the retail electronics biz, And unless a buyer magically appears in the next few weeks, it's all over. Personally, I'm surprised there's been no interest in the stores. After all, who on Long Island wouldn't want to go into the corporate headquarters of Cablevision and take a whiz? Sad news on the science front. Dolly the sheep, the world's first cloned mammal, was euthanized on Valentine's Day, owing to arthritis and lung disease prematurely aging the animal. When she was 2 and 3 years old, Dolly sired several healthy children, showing that clones can reproduce. But the average life expectancy for a sheep is 11 or 12 years. A Dolly lived only half that. Scientists are investigating whether the fact that Dolly was cloned from a 6-year-old sheep meant that she came into the world already at age 6 and that she was predisposed to extremely premature aging. In a related story, baby Eve, the alleged first cloned human baby, born December 2002, is said by the Raelian sect to be alive and well and living in Israel. She is, however, on Social Security, eats dinner at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and rails endlessly about the kids today and their terrible, terrible music. Still, whether or not baby Eve is a hoax, it's only fitting to say a fond farewell to a real clone, Dolly the sheep. Dolly, here's to you. Goodbye, Dolly. Well, goodbye, Dolly. It's so sad that you succumbed to lung disease. You were sick, Dolly. Aged too quick, Dolly. Now they're cutting up your mutton just for samples to freeze. You were first, Dolly. Also cursed, Dolly. So they put you in a permanent sleep sheep. They'll do an exam now that you're an ex-lamb. Maybe one day they will clone Bo Peep. Farewell, Dolly. Now you smell, Dolly, because the scientists decided you should die. You were sweet, Dolly. Now you're meat, Dolly. You'll be shish kebab and gobs and blobs of shepherd's pie. You made babies till you got scabies. And cancer in your lungs began to grow. So, from now till next autumn, they'll do a post-mortem. Dolly was no folly, no. Golly gee, golly oh. Dolly, we're so sorry to see you go. On the entertainment front, the firestorm of controversy continues over a British documentary purported to show the real Michael Jackson. Though many felt the film to be hostile and biased, it did show the world-famous entertainer engaging in bizarre behavior and espousing outrageous opinions. Jackson also went on record saying that he enjoyed sleeping, albeit asexually, with little boys and girls. This led many parenting groups and watchdog organizations to say that Jackson is unfit to be an entertainer or any kind of public figure, and he should leave the music business entirely. On the plus side, the Catholic Diocese of Rockville Center has already sent him an application for the priesthood. More music news. For the first time in their history, the Rolling Stones are going to play a gig in China. If all the contracts work out, the group will do 2 shows in Shanghai and Beijing. Despite government censorship there, the Stones will be allowed to perform what they want, the way they want. However, as a cultural nod to the people there, Mick Jagger and Keith Richard will change the titles of many of their most famous tunes. For example, fans at the Chinese concerts will be able to hear such classics as Hey You, Get Off of My Tank, Lady Jade, Paint It Red, Hong Kongy Tonk Woman, Year of the Monkey Man, It's Only Lock and Lull, Sister Opium, and Memory Deprogramming Motel. Also, they'll do a special medley devoted to Chinese cooking, Stray Cat Blues, Walking the Dog, and You Can't Always Get What You Want, But If You Order the Lunch Special, you get a free soup and pork fried rice. Now, I've heard of crowds getting out of control at a Stones concert, but in Saudi Arabia, the crowd was uncontainable at a stone throwing concert. Returning from their pilgrimage to Mecca, thousands of pilgrims spent the afternoon on Mount Arafat. Yes, Mount Arafat. And then trekked to the city of Mena. It's kind of the Arab equivalent of Knott's Berry Farm, where Muslims get to throw little rocks like a big stone pillar representing the devil. This year, of course, many of the pebble-pelting participants used the pillar to symbolize those twin devils the United States and Israel, which is why I find it hard to sympathize when, year after year, the crowd gets too big and a stampede ensues. This year's body count, 14, is actually way down from the 1998 record of 119 deaths by trampling. The real question is, what is there always some connection between the name Arafat and Arabs throwing rocks? And why, if the annual Hajj is about the sanctity of life, do they slaughter thousands of sheep, goats, and camels for food and sacrifice? And why do they need a stone pillar to represent sin when Whitney Houston is alive and still walking among us? I'm going to finish up the news gone by now with one last little story. Speaking of animals, some classic Americana from the Associated Press. The celebrated jumping frogs of Calaveras County, California, immortalized in a short story by Mark Twain, have just won a big legal battle. Last year, California wildlife officials warned it was illegal to return frogs to the wild after they were used in a jumping contest. It wasn't unlawful to catch the frogs and use them in competition, but returning them to their habitat was forbidden for fear of their spreading disease or altering the ecosystem. But then officials found a loophole, an obscure provision to the Fish and Game Code that says frogs used in jumping contests are exempt from wildlife rules. That's good news for the 2,000 frogs captured every year for the leaping contest. And since the law encompasses other animals used in competitions, that's good news for Mike Tyson, who fights Claude Etienne this Saturday and then can be returned to his natural habitat. Asked if it was safe to release Tyson amidst wild tigers, bears, and hyenas, Fish and Wildlife Director Steve Williams said, "Probably not, but the animals will just have to fend for themselves." And that's the news gone by for February 16th, 2003. Please send your comments, opinions, and raw oysters to Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062, or email us at davesgoneby@aol.com. Please, no throwing pebbles. I'm allergic to Flintstones. Anyway, it's a little after 8 on WGBB AM 1240 Freeport. I'm going to leave you live now and put on a tape that I did a few weeks ago. Still more Dave, still more wonderful stuff, but we'll be back in the studio if the snow doesn't cover all of the world entirely. And I'll see you all next week, but please keep listening. There's an hour of great music ahead.
Hi, Kamalala, Yasser Arafat.
Howdy, this is Yasser Arafat. Coming to you from beautiful downtown Ramallah.
Dave's Gone By.
And you're listening to Dave's Gone By.
I'm on WGBB 1240 Freeport.
On WGBB AM 1240 Freeport. Who stole my goat?
The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to a special, rather different edition of Dave's Gone By. Those of you who listen every Sunday from 11 to midnight know that my show is generally a mix of talk radio, comedy, and music, sometimes with very little time for music. But this episode makes up for that. Call it a self-indulgence, if you will. There are many reasons why I always wanted to do a radio show like Dave's Gone By, getting my voice heard, my opinions out there, sharing my sense of humor, and giving people a few belly laughs if I can. But I'm also a DJ at heart. In my youth, I listened to commercial radio, everything from Casey Kasem's American Top 40 to the old NEW, where rock lived, to a pre-disco folk music, WKTU. It always seemed like both a treat and a serious creative endeavor to choose which records to play and share them with the world. Leaving aside commercialism and payola and all that, just balancing what the audience might like with what record companies want to promote with what you're just dying to hear yourself struck me as one of the best jobs in the world. I've only got 1 hour here on Sunday nights, so I can't play one zillionth of the music I want to, especially since this is generally a talk and comedy show with music thrown in just for a breather. But as I said, today I am a DJ. I like what I play. And topping off this idealized moment, every song will be by one artist, a man whose music changed my life, my way of hearing music, of songwriting, of reacting to everything and everyone around me. The man, the muse, the music, the miracle, Bob Dylan.
New clothes, but lately I see her. ribbons and her bows. Have fun from her curls. She takes just like a woman. Yes, she does. She makes love just like a woman. Yes, she does. And she aches just like a woman. But she breaks just like a little girl. She's my friend. Yes, I believe I'll go see her again. Nobody has to guess that baby can't be blessed till she finally sees that she's like all the rest, with her fog, her amphetamine, and her pearls. She takes just like a woman. Yes, she makes love just like a woman. Yes, she does. And she aches just like a woman. But she breaks just like a little girl. It was rain from the first, and I was dying of thirst, so I came in here. And your long time curse hurts, but what's worse is this pain in here. I can't stay in here. Ain't it clear that I just can't fit? Yes, I believe it's time for us to quit. And when we meet again, introduced as friends, please don't let on that you knew me when I was hungry and it was your world. Ah, you fake just like a woman. Yes, you do. Make love just like a woman. Yes, you do. Then you ache just like a woman. But you break just like a little girl.
Before the commercial, we just heard Just Like a Woman from the Blonde on Blonde album, a song that's been labeled everything from sexist to cliché, but only by people who refuse to get lost in the sheer sound of it. That melodic sing-song, that beautiful harmonica. And before that, Tell Me Mama, recorded live in Manchester, May 17, 1966. It still astonishes me how that blistering, rollicking piece of rock and roll could have collected dust in Columbia Records vaults for 30 years. At last, the so-called Royal Albert Hall concert was released 4 years ago as part four of the bootleg series called Live 1966. It's been both frustrating and thrilling how CBS has parceled out its rare Dylan material over the years, scattering gems across the Biograph collection, and then going all out with the indispensable bootleg series. And apparently, we've only heard the tip of the iceberg. Every recent Dylan biography carps about how much extraordinary music is still unavailable to the general public. And I can vouch, because I've heard rarities on the radio or in bootlegs over the years, shook my head and wondered, how can that not be on CD? Granted, most of the really monumental stuff would come from just 3 years, 1965, 66, and 67. But when you consider how many years Dylan has been continuously touring, and that there's been a tape recorder rolling on him for just about everything he's done since 1961, even if there's just a half hour of essential music per year, the mind boggles at what might be out there, unheralded, unheard. Now, Bob Dylan, the Beatles, Neil Young, and arguably the Stones are about the only artists in rock history who could put out a five-hour greatest hits package and still not include every worthy tune. I'll use that as one excuse why this show leans heavily on Dylan's 60s and mid-70s albums, pretty much bypassing all the folk and protest stuff and jumping over the 80s and 90s entirely, even his great comeback with Time Out of Mind. I also feel that, as remarkable as his lyrics can be, Dylan's greatness was as much in the sounds of his songs as the songs themselves, hence the preponderance of full-blown rock and roll tonight. Even Dylan knew there was something divinely inspired about what he called that thin, wild Mercury sound on Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61 Revisited, and Blonde on Blonde. Call it alchemy, be it with the Hawks, later renamed the band, or with Nashville musicians like Kenneth Buttry and Joe South. The mix of Bob's fuzzy, sawdust-soaked, cigar-smoked voice with Robbie Robertson's clear guitar and swirling carnival organ from Al Kooper or Garth Hudson remains the headiest clamor in all rock, especially when the songs combine a great sense of urgent desperation with party-time exhilaration. You get it on Rainy Day Women, Like a Rolling Stone, the live version of Most Likely You Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine, and this cut from Highway 61, the thrilling bass-driven from a Buick 6.
Pipeline gets broken and I lost on the river bridge. I'm all cracked up. your pawnbroker roared. Oh, so did the landlord. You see me so crazy. Wasn't you? Both were so glad to watch me destroy what I had. Pain sure brings out the best in people, drives me in. Why didn't you just leave me? Maybe you didn't want to stay. Why'd you have to treat me so bad? Did it have to be that way? Now you stand here expecting me to remember something you forgot to say. Yes, and you, I see you're still with her. Well, that's fine, but she's coming on so strange, can't you tell? Somebody better explain. She's got her iron chain. I do it, but I just can't remember how. You talk to her, she's your lover now. Look like Charles Atlee.
Maybe my second favorite Dylan song of all time. Breaks my heart that he never finished it, or he never laid down a finished take. She's Your Lover Now, which saw the light of day on Volume 2 of the Bootleg series. I think the saddest part of Dylan's motorcycle accident in 1967 is that his songs would never have such complex structures again. She's Your Lover Now, Visions of Johanna, and a song we'll hear later, One of Us Must Know, go places melodically, building towards crescendos and retreats that I guess Dylan couldn't or wouldn't return to. Maybe the crash finally gave him that chance to unload his head. He pushed the envelope again on The Great Idiot Wind, and he wasn't averse to writing long and winding songs like Brownsville Girl, Joey, Hurricane, and Highlands, but only rarely were the long story songs as rousing as this one from the Desire collection, Isis.
I married Isis on the 5th day of May, but I could not hold on to her very long. So I cut off my hair and I rode straight away for the wild unknown country where I could not go wrong. I came to a high place of darkness and light. The budding light ran through the center of town. I hitched up my pony to a post on the right. Went into a laundry to wash my clothes down. A man in the corner approached me for a match. I knew right away he was not ordinary. He said, "Are you looking for something easy to catch?" Said, "I got no money." That ain't necessary. We set out that night for the cold in the north. I gave him my blanket and he gave me his word. I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "We'll be back by the fourth." I said, "That's the best news that I've ever heard." I was thinking about turquoise, I was thinking about gold, I was thinking about diamonds and the world's biggest necklace. As we rode through the canyons, through the devilish cold, I was thinking about ISIS, how she thought I was so reckless. How she told me that one day we would meet up again, and things would be different the next time we were. If I only could I hang on and just be her friend. I still can't remember all the best things she said. We came to the pyramids all embedded in ice. He said, "There's a body I'm trying to find. If I carry it out, it'll bring a good price." 'Twas the then that I knew what he had on his mind. The wind, it was a howling, and the snow was outrageous. We chopped through the night, and we chopped through the dawn. When he died, I was hoping that it wasn't contagious. But I made up my mind that I had to go on. I broke into the tomb, but the casket was empty. There was no jewels, no nothing. I felt I'd been had. When I saw that my partner was just being friendly, when I took a his offer, I must have been mad.
dedicated stem to stern to Bob Dylan. Born May 24, 1941, as Robert Allen Zimmerman in Hibbing, Minnesota, Dylan was already going electric in high school, years before he went folk. And there are several different stories as to why Zimmy picked Dylan as a surname. The most reasonable are that it was just either for poet Dylan Thomas or TV gunfighter Matt Dylan, or a combo of both. He just liked the sound of the name. Although I was too young to catch the Rolling Thunder tour, I've seen Dylan live several times in my life, and I'll never forget the first experience. I was 14 years old, late September 1978. Dylan came to New York and was playing Nassau Coliseum and then Madison Square Garden. My junior high school friend Scott and I were both Dylan fanatics at that point. In fact, that's how we initially became best friends. We bonded over bringing it all back home in Highway 61. But we both needed chaperones to go to a rock concert. So my parents volunteered. Now, granted, this is not like parents who have to take their teen daughters to Britney Spears or the Backstreet Boys and just listen to the audience shrieking for 2 hours. But my folks still weren't prepared, nor was I, for the volume level of a rock concert. Both shows were piercingly loud, or at least they seemed so at the time. Later I'd go to other concerts and play in a band myself, and undoubtedly sustain some hearing damage from both. But, I just remember my dad and me sitting there with our fingers in our ears the first time, and then coming to MSG 2 days later, better prepared with earplugs. And my friend Scott and I had a blast, even though we kind of knew this wasn't Bob at his best. He was pushing the Street Legal album, which was good, but nothing close to the music he'd been making until then. Mercifully, this was before his Born Again period, but he already had the gospel singers and a blaring saxophone and the whole glitzy Vegas thing going on. And the arrangements were often different from the originals, which is what you expect of Dylan, but that certainly doesn't mean they were better. It was basically the sound you hear on the Live at Budokan set, which means it's more entertaining than you'd expect, but it's not the first or third or tenth Bob Dylan album you'd reach for. The main point is, slick and professional as the gigs were, Dylan made a lot more powerful music with the ragtag Rolling Thunder outfit just 2 years earlier. You want proof? Here he is off the Bootleg Series, Volume 3, circa April 1976, with 7 Days.
My beautiful comrade, come and know her. the nights are always sadder than the day.
Welcome back to this special Dylan-esque edition of Dave's Gone By, which I wish were 5 hours long instead of one. I'm pining for the songs I had to leave out tonight, like Positively 4th Street, Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window, Like a Rolling Stone, and of course, Rainy Day Women, Sarah, Simple Twist of Fate, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue. I decided to concentrate on hard rock and numbers this time, no pure folk and just a ballad or two. I figure we always hear how Dylan's lyrics transformed rock, how his protest numbers were so meaningful, how his sandpaper voice and nasal delivery changed the definition of a quote-unquote great singer. But this show is about everything melding together. The lyrics, the voice, the musicians, the arrangements, the total sound of those 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 minutes. You can isolate the elements, unless you're Sebastian Cabot, but when it all comes to you at once, that's when the effect is overwhelming. Case in point, my favorite Dylan song, One of Us Must Know Sooner or Later, a relatively obscure cut from the pinnacle album Blonde on Blonde. So obscure, in fact, that years ago, when I won a contest sponsored by a commercial radio station that shall remain K-Rock, they wouldn't play it. I won a CD player for sending in a postcard of my 3 favorite rock songs of all time, Bowie's Heroes, The Stones' Gimme Shelter, and One of Us Must Know. They played the first 2 songs, but when it came time for the Dylan, they played Stuck Inside of Mobile with the Memphis Blues again, because my song wasn't on their official playlist. I don't know what kind of retarded logic tells a station you can play track 6 on a CD, but not track 4 on the same CD, especially when there's nothing objectionable on either track, but that's radio. I wish I had the cojones to tell the station, keep your stupid prize and just give me free radio instead. But I took the CD player, and the first song I played on it, you got it. One of Us Must Know is, by the way, the only song on Blonde on Blonde recorded in New York, not Nashville. It has just a little more wild energy and orchestrated swirl. In concert, I've heard Dylan call it one of his own favorite compositions. The lyrics feel personal and confessional. The vocal bellows and blusters and begs. The music pulses and whips everything into a whirlpool of sound, from Paul Griffin's bluesy piano to Robbie Robertson's spare guitar to Al Kooper's ever-so-brief, ever-so-heartbreaking organ solo. This is the height of rock and roll. Dylan, January 25th, 1966. One of Us Must Know Sooner or Later. Dylan, January 25th, 1966. One of Us Must Know Sooner or Later.
I didn't mean to treat you so bad. You shouldn't take it so personal. I didn't mean make you so sad. You just happen to be there, that's all. When I saw you say goodbye to your friend and smile, I thought that it was well understood that you'd be coming back in a little while. I didn't know that you were saying goodbye for good. Oh, sooner or later, one of us must know that you just did what you're supposed to do. Sooner or later,
to get close to you. I couldn't see what you could show me. Your scarf, it kept your mouth well hidden. I couldn't see how you could know me. But you said you knew me, and I believed you did. When you whispered in my ear and asked me if I was leaving with you or her, I didn't realize just what I did hear. I didn't realize how young you were. Oh, sooner or later, one of us must know that you're just doing what you're supposed to do. Sooner or later, one of us must know that I really did try to get close to you. I couldn't see when it started snowing. Your voice was all that I heard. I couldn't see where we were going, but you said you knew, and I took your word. And then you told me later, as I apologized, that you were just kidding me, you weren't really from the farm. And I told you as you clawed out my eyes that I never really meant to do you any harm. Oh, sooner or later, one of us must know that you just did what you're supposed to do. Sooner or later, one of us must know that I really did try to get close to you.
Buckets of tears, got all them buckets coming out of my ears, buckets of moonbeams in my hand. You got all the love, honey, baby, I can stand.
You've been listening to an hour of Bob Dylan. For me, as great a way as you can spend an hour. We just heard One of Us Must Know from Blonde on Blonde, and we're closing with Buckets of Rain from Blood on the Tracks.
Like an oak, I've seen pretty people disappear like smoke. Friends will arrive, friends will disappear. If you want me, honey, baby, I'll be here.
To see a playlist for this evening's program, check our website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. There's also info about the Bystanders Club, advertising, and regular features we didn't get to tonight.
Fingertips. I like the way that you move your hips. I like the cool way you look at me. Everything about you is bringing me misery.
I want to thank some folks for helping me with the show. Station manager Joey, engineer Paul, my wife and assistant Joyce, and the music of Bob Dylan for helping me unload my head and keep my times a-changing.
Little red wagon, little red bike. I ain't no monkey, but I know what I like. I like the way you love me strong and slow. I'm taking you with me, honey, baby, when I go.
Thank you also to Engineer Joe. If you have comments or questions about Dave's Gone By, please send them to davesgoneby@aol.com or by snail mail to P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557.
Life is sad, life is a bust. All you can do is do what you must. You do what you must do, and you do it well. I do it for you, honey, baby, can't you tell?
Tune in next week for a very different episode of Dave's Gone By. Until then, ring them bells, crawl out your window, knock on heaven's door, go follow your heart, dance beneath the diamond sky, ask where it is, jump your railroad gate, look inside your mirror, light yourself a candle, strike another match, go start anew, stay forever young. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night, good morning, and gone by.